Please listen carefully.
And now, live from the Zudio in McKinney, Texas, it's the Assuming Positions Podcast, featuring two guys flapping gums and being chums, Kevin and Mikey.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Assuming Positions Podcast. Kevin over here.
And Mikey over here.
And today on the podcast, we have a new theme we're calling Pizza Party.
Our eight slice extravaganza.
Yes, the Pizza Party eight slice extravaganza. Now, this was all inspired by a listener's email that we got and we read last week.
Yes, on our Red Dawn Rebootle episode 2012.
Yeah, so thanks to John Jordan for actually inspiring an idea. So for those of you who didn't listen to that podcast, go back and listen to it anyway. But just a little recap, John loves our podcast. Thank you, John. But he had a little bit of an issue with an earlier reassumptions we did for the movie A Knight's Tale.
Yep.
Where Mikey gave it 8 out of 8, which he agreed with is 8 out of 8 in his mind. But I gave it 6 out of 8. And he thought, how could any card-carrying nerd who loves to go to Renaissance festivals and play Dungeons & Dragons, how could he give a movie like A Knight's Tale a 6 out of 8 and not an 8 out of 8?
Mm-hmm. And spoiler alert, it's just because you're a tough critic, which is fair, but go back and listen to the episode for the actual explanation. So, yes.
Right. Now, in my defense, I didn't have the numbers in front of me at the time, but I went and looked at the numbers. So, on Metacritic, A Knight's Tale got a 56%.
Blasphemy.
Now, a 6 out of 8 is 75%. So I'm well above the average movie critic.
That's fair.
So I'm more around what the audience score is. The audience, they use users on Metacritic, which is like 6.9. So that's closer to 75%.
There you go.
Out of 10, I believe. So anyway, I guess I'm more of an audience member than a critic in that regard, but not enough of a nerd for John, which is fine. But this got me to thinking, what do we give 8 out of 8? Giving something, he's right, giving something 8 out of 8 slices of pizza, that's our rating system for those of you guys who don't know. We rate all our things that we love based on pizza pie cut into 8 slices. And will we eat all 8 slices because it's so delicious, or will we just leave some there because it's not so good?
Yes.
So my idea was is that everyone has a certain kind of thing that they like. Let's just say a pizza for the analogy, since we're using that. A certain kind of pizza they like that some people are like, oh, wow, that says a lot about you. Like, for example, the pineapple pizza controversy.
Oh, I'm on pineapple, team pineapple, yes.
And I'm not on team pineapple at all. So that's our Siskel and Ebert here of pineapple on pizza. But regardless, some people will eat the whole pineapple pizza and love it, and some people won't even want to touch a slice of it. So
it's
that kind of thing. It says a lot about somebody that they like this thing. So there's some obvious 8 out of 8s that everybody gives, that even most nerds give, like Star Wars, you know, or like Princess Bride, if we're talking about movies here.
Yeah, and also stuff that we've talked about on the podcast, like Firefly and Star Trek. Like, there are some sort of defaults. Like, everybody agrees this is good. You may have your nitpicks with it, but everybody agrees that it's a full pizza, you know, so.
Yeah, exactly. So I didn't want to come at my explanation of, like, this is what I like. Saving Private Ryan, 8 out of 8. It's like, come on, man. You know, it's, right?
Yep.
But it says a lot about, like, our producer, Not Scott. He gives the movie Buckaroo Banzai 8 out of 8.
Yes.
Now, the funny thing about Not Scott is, looking at him, you wouldn't peg him as a person who would do such a thing. You wouldn't.
You wouldn't.
You wouldn't at all.
Yeah.
Now,
Buckaroo Banzai, really?
Yeah, he loves Star Wars. He has like Star Wars t-shirts and like, and you get that. You're like, oh, that guy likes Star Wars. That makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
But then when you're like, when he pulls out Buckaroo Banzai, it's kind of like, huh? So says a lot about him. So that's my point. So we decided for, long story short, we decided for the 8 slice extravaganza is that on this episode, we're going to bring a movie, a TV show, and a video game that we give 8 slices to that you might not expect to get 8 slices / for us to give 8 slices. Now, some of the stuff to a lot of people is an 8 slice thing, but we're not trying to find something that like other people don't like, but I like. No. You know what I mean?
We're just giving the listeners a deep look into our personal lives, and hey, these are our favorites, and yes, we're nerdy, and here's specifically where we are nerdy.
Yes. So hopefully this will help the listeners learn a little bit more about me and you and the kind of stuff that we're into and that we like, that because sometimes stuff doesn't warrant a reassumption. True. So it would never come up. So you'd never learn that about us. So we're coming to a pizza party here, and we got three pies, and we're going to tell you what these pies are.
Yes.
So for the first one, a movie. So Mikey, we know, what are some of the movies that we know that you already give eight slices to? You've talked about it a million times on the podcast. Fifth Element, right?
Fifth Element absolutely is one of them. You can talk to Craftmaster Ted, Evil Ted. He was one of the persons working on it, and I flipped out on him. Like, it was great. I love Fifth Element. We've talked about it a bunch. But I also think that there's already a sort of an audience for that. So movies for me, I'm going old school. Like a nerd, I keep a list of my favorite movies of all time. I think that's a quality of a nerd. You have to keep a list of what's your favorite and keep it ranked. But for me, number one is an old black and white movie. I've watched this movie so many times in my life. This is foundational for me, and I love it. But for me, the 8 out of 8 slices, the pizza extravaganza in movies, is 12 Angry Men from 1957.
Oh, wow. See, that does say a lot about Mikey the millennial.
But hey, there you go.
Right?
It is an old black and white movie, and I think there's, I don't know, maybe this is me growing up with film nerds in my friend group, but I think everybody has the time when they dip back into old movies, and you go to classics. You go to, like, Citizen Kane or, like, Alfred Hitchcock, you know, there are those classics that are in there, but 12 Angry Men rarely seems to come up in conversation.
Right. So like the Hitchcock movies and Citizen Kane is obviously most people would give 8 out of 8.
Yeah. And I'm not saying like 12 Angry Men is an unrecognized classic, because like Criterion Collection has a deluxe edition of it. So people, like, it is already celebrated, but
for someone your age.
Oh, absolutely. No. This is one of those, I think we've talked about it on the podcast before, but if it comes up on TNT on a Sunday on TV, I'm sitting down to watch it and forgetting all my chores for the rest of the day because I got to finish this movie.
Right.
Have you ever seen 12 Angry Men?
I believe I have, but give me the breakdown of it. It's about a jury, right? Deciding on a case.
That's it. That's the whole movie. It's 90 minutes, which is already, that's thumbs up from Mikey. If you can tell a story in an hour and 30 minutes and be one and done, oh, perfect. You already succeeded. But this is a 90-minute black and white movie about 12 jury members that have to decide a case about an 18-year-old that supposedly committed murder. That's it. That's the whole entirety of this movie. You know the whole plot with that sentence. So already going into that, you wonder, how can this movie be so captivating? But this is old school Hollywood. This is... The director is Sidney Lumet, who is a name that's, you know, already famous. He did Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, Dog Day Afternoon. He's got an IMDb list as long as my arm, you know. So he's already certified, but this is his first sort of directorial debut. So this is like early Sidney Lumet. Like when,
oh, wow.
He was a genius, but people didn't recognize it at first. But it's 12 jurors in a room. It's a bottle episode, as our show community likes to say. You know, the entire 90 minutes takes place in one room, with the exception of like maybe two bathroom scenes. But other than that, it's in this jury room, and it really is a 90-minute movie about 12 men arguing with each other, trying to get to the bottom of this argument. Which, me saying it out loud, looking at it on paper, sounds kind of boring. Like, you would like, okay, it's just 12 men having an argument. Who cares, right? But the camera work, the staging, the framing, the dialogue, the way none of the characters have names. They're all just juror 7, juror 12, juror 5. That's it. They don't get names. The characters aren't important. It's just what's going on in this room is so captivating, and it's crafted so well that it's a masterpiece. I love this movie. I could watch it every day of the week.
Aren't there some pretty big stars in this, too?
Yeah, we're talking old school Hollywood, like I said, but Henry Fonda is the main juror, and he's the catalyst for sort of the argument that happened, because here's more of the setup, I guess. It is 12 jurors arguing a case, and 11 of them say, "Oh, it's one and done. It's an open and shut case. This kid murdered this guy. We're done. Let's leave in 20 minutes." But Henry Fonda speaks up, and he's like, "Maybe he didn't do it." And so they have a discussion about that. But it's Henry Fonda, it's Ed Begley, it's Jack Warden, it's just those classic Hollywood theatrical sort of people, you know, that are trained to do everything with the small space that they're given. But
well, it's funny. It's got like parents of from families, the Begleys and the Fondas. It's like the original family members that founded all these other actors who followed them. That's crazy.
Yeah. But their family members continue to be Hollywood acts. So it kind of makes sense. But the main players in this movie are captivating. The dialogue is captivating, but there's just something magical about the way that it's crafted. There's deliberate sort of camera angles for the, like, and we're talking 1950s again. This is black and white movie. You don't expect them to be sort of mainstays in Hollywood to this day, but I argue that this film is, because as the film progresses, the camera gets lower and lower to create a mood. Like, that's a cameraman thinking critically, you know? There's a play between foreground and background as far as the characters go and as they make the argument. And you don't even notice this. Like, you're just watching this movie and it's like, oh, black and white, cool. They're having an argument, whatever. But the movie is so well crafted that it's bringing you along whether you like it or not. And that's just, I can't get enough of this movie.
That's great, man. So to me, what that shows is that Mikey over there is that's a very almost like film school kid thing to pick.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I got you.
You really appreciate the art of film. You really, and I can tell from other things you've reviewed, and that's kind of what it is. You're a cinephile, I guess, as they would call it.
I'm down with it. I'm okay with that label.
Yeah. Because my 8-slice film is a lot fluffier than that. And I would argue could easily be made into a Star Wars movie, but it's set in a whole different era. And I come by this movie very honestly. This is something that I didn't know I loved so much until I watched it recently. And I knew pretty much every line in the movie. And I was quoting it and getting excited for parts like I would do when watching something like Star Wars.
But that also means annoying your family by calling out the lines while the movie is going on, right?
Yes, 100%. 100%. So I can't remember if it was like 4th of July time, or it was some kind of like Yay America time, and we wanted to watch a movie.
Yes.
And I said, oh, you know what my teenage boys haven't seen? That's fine for them to see because it's not too crazy graphic. Like, I would love them to see stuff like Band of Brothers and stuff, or, you know, The Pacific, or even the Saving Private Ryan can get a little rough there. And I'm sure they'd be fine with it because they know movie magic. But anyway, we wanted something lighter. Saving Private Ryan's pretty heavy for a war, Yay America movie.
Especially those first 20 minutes. Oh, man.
Yeah. So I hit on a movie that I knew I loved, but I didn't know I loved it so much. And that movie was 1990s Memphis Belle.
Oh, Memphis Belle. What a great pick. Yes.
Now, you know that I've said this before through the Red Dawn things. I'm kind of a military history nerd, too. I read World War II books like crazy. I have been, like, the first book I ever bought when I was a kid was a World War II book.
Oh, okay.
It was just a general history of World War II book.
Okay.
That's the nerd level you're getting with this guy over here, you know?
Yep.
So I've always been just so interested in that era. A lot of people are. It's clear that those years kind of were a big world changer. It literally changed the game in the world. Everything's different after the Second World War happened. So it's interesting. If you're into history, if you're into like what's going on today, even politically, it all tracks back to that one time, which is kind of crazy. So I've always been into it. So anytime these movies would come out, like anytime these war movies, World War II related things, I just devour them, eat them up, love them. But Memphis Belle is an interesting one because as a tough critic on things and a guy who gets annoyed that paratroopers are dropping in the middle of town or wasting their ammo places, this movie is not historically accurate at all to what the Memphis Belle itself did. it's more like a movie that they just wanted to show what the bomber pilots went through in World War II. So what's Memphis Belle about? I guess we should get into it. No one knows, but Memphis Belle is about a World War II B-17 bomber crew who's running their last mission over Germany to drop bombs on the Germans.
Mm-hmm.
And the deal is that after you did 25 missions, you got to basically go home. You got to go back and they put you in a training role or something like that. But the thing about the air war in World War II is that it was so dangerous that most bomber crews didn't make it to 25.
Oh, wow.
They just didn't. So whenever someone did make it to 25, it was a big deal. So there was a documentary that was done about the Memphis Belle because it was so rare for it to happen. And I've seen the documentary. It was a 1944 documentary. So it was a documentary from the era, from the war, called Memphis Belle, A Story of a Flying Fortress by William Wyler. It's a very well-known documentary. And they kind of were inspired to do this movie from that documentary. And it was actually produced by William Wyler's daughter.
Oh, fun.
But it doesn't follow exactly what went on in the documentary because they wanted to dramatize it more because their 25th mission was actually fairly fine. but
that doesn't settle in Hollywood yet. No, I get you.
Yeah. So they actually, what they did was, is like, then this should annoy me, but it doesn't because this movie is so lovingly done and they had all good intentions. So what they did was, is that all of the characters are composites. They aren't actually the guys who are on the crew anyway.
Okay.
And what happens in the mission is kind of a composite of what happened in many different missions.
But sort of condensed into one mission to make it the last hurrah. Okay.
Exactly. So everything is fact-based. All these things happen to somebody, and all these people are based on somebody, but they kind of just pulled it all together to make one story as a representation of the air war, the daylight bombing raids that happened over Germany. So the reason why I bring that all up is because as a tough critic and as someone who gets upset about inaccurate stuff, I don't care. As far as this movie goes, this is an I don't care. This is a... And that's why I kind of compare it to a Star Wars, because I know the lines from it. And just like in Star Wars, the ships don't fly like that in space. Ships don't make noise in space. I know all these things, the things that annoy Star Trek and other people who don't like Star Wars. And the fact is, I don't care.
I get it.
So, and it's the same thing. I don't care. So this movie was, I don't know how many people know about this movie because it was, I mean, it did fine. It's reviewed fine, but I don't know why I must have watched this movie a billion times because when I'm watching it there with my kids, I'm like, oh, here's this part. And I'm saying lines, and it's got just a murderer's row of early 90s stars in it.
Lay it on
you.
Yeah.
Lay it on you. Okay. So 1990s Memphis Belle has in it the captain of the B-17 Memphis Belle is Matthew Modine.
Ooh, okay.
The co-pilot is Tate Donovan. Right? The navigator's D.B. Sweeney. The bombardier's Billy Zane.
Oh, Billy Zane, yeah.
Eric Stoltz is the radio man.
Oh, original Marty McFly, yep.
Right? Sean Astin is the ball gunner.
It's Samwise Gamgee. How can you go wrong?
Courtney Gaines is one of the side gunners. And the tail gunner is Harry Connick Jr.
Oh, I forgot about him, yeah.
Right? Yes, man, come on. It was his first role ever, his first movie role.
Oh, wow, okay.
Yeah, it's his debut role. And John Lithgow is in it as well as like the publicity officer who's making a bigger deal out of the mission and the boys completing it successfully than the colonel in charge of everything.
I get you.
Who's played by David Strahan.
Yeah.
So it's also a big name too. So, I mean, the cast is great. It's amazing. And it's so well acted. It's well written. It's dramatic the whole way through. They used five real B-17s in it.
Oh, fun. Okay.
That they would repaint to make it look like they were other ones. I mean, there's tons of practical effects in it. They used actual P-51s. They used actual... There was no German aircraft, but there were Spanish versions of it that were looked the same.
Oh, okay.
That were built by Spain that they used. So the dogfight scenes in this are real.
Oh,
there's
okay.
Real planes flying around. So it's done practically. There is some early CG stuff in it. There is some of that and model work too, which is also practical. that does it hold up 100%? I don't know. To me, again, it's like Star Wars, the old Star Wars. When you watch it, you don't really care because it's doing what it needs to do. But there's humorous moments, the camaraderie between the guys. You know, you got the B plot of the overall commander and John Lithgow's character at odds because the overall commander knows that they might not actually come back. And John Lithgow, as the publicity guy, is planning like a big, huge welcome home party and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got that kind of stuff in it. It's got a big scene where, to prove his point, the overall commander makes John Lithgow read letters that came in from family members who had lost people in the air war and stuff. And those were real letters that were read.
Oh, that's cool.
And they're reading it over the top of actual real combat footage and stuff. I mean, it's a great movie to watch during like a Memorial Day or a Veterans Day or something like that, because I guess that's why I don't care about the inaccuracies of that. This isn't actually what happened on Memphis Belle's 25th mission. It doesn't matter because this movie was made in tribute. And at the end, it even has a tribute to everyone on both sides who fought in the air war over Europe. So it's like a memorial movie. It's lovingly made. They lost, man, there was tragedy in it. They lost one of the B-17s. It crashed trying to take off. Thankfully, everyone lived, but...
Oh, wait, in the movie you're talking about?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, one of the real ones got destroyed.
Oh, no.
Which stinks because there's not that many of them. But it just... This is an 8 out of 8 movie for it. I just love it so much. It just hits on all levels. It hits you in the feels in the right way. And, I mean... These guys are at the height of their powers. Eric Stoltz is kind of the main character of it in a way. Mm-hmm. He plays Danny Boy. And, of course, they get Harry Connick Jr. singing in it, which is great. and I even loved it so much. I had the soundtrack on CD. The soundtrack was amazing because it had
all the early swing and all the early like big band stuff, right?
Yeah, it had big band stuff. But intermixed with it was the actual soundtrack of the movie, which is kind of this orchestral... Very like moving, I'm up in a plane soaring type pieces.
It's
just amazing. But there's so many, like there's so many quotable things to me that I say it to people and they don't know. So I know this movie isn't 8 out of 8 for a lot of people.
I got you.
You know, this, because one of my favorite things that happens in this movie is, I mean, Sean Astin, you got to love Sean Astin anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And he's so good. He's the ball turret gunner. And the ball turret was a really dangerous place to be. You were locked in a little tiny ball that hung down from the bottom of the B-17. It looked like something from Star Wars itself, like a little turret thing back there.
And you're an easy target, yep.
Yeah, you were an easy target. And a lot of times, if you could get stuck in there, and a lot of times if the bomber, like if the landing gear went out and you were stuck in there, you get squished. It was a terrible place to be. But there's at one point where they're all calling out the fighters, and the fighters are coming in, and you know, you get to see him like because he's like in a little fetal position. He's got these little triggers like near his head almost, and he's like pop, 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 pop. And one of the planes like flies, the German planes flies right under him, and he's like, that guy had blue eyes. I don't know. Just the delivery by Sean Astin is great. So,
but that's the closeness of war. Like, that's how close planes got to each other in dogfights. And here's the compliment I will give this movie, because I am also a fan of Memphis Belle. I'm not sure if I'm an 8 out of 8 slices like you are, but I love the personal preference. But for as much as they sort of made a story out of all the events of the historical Memphis Belle, it's cool that they, like, this is a period piece to the extreme. All the costumes are right. All the pinup girls on the planes are right.
Yeah.
All the enemy planes are right. Like, it's cool to hear that they had a couple B-bombers, you know, ready to go to make this at least somewhat historically accurate. So,
yep.
It's cool. But for brain memories for me, there are certain quotes and certain scenes, but for when I think of Memphis Belle, the first scene that always comes into my head is... He's going. I forget who it is, but he's going to throw his lucky necklace, his lucky charm, out the window,
right? You know,
to mess with the crew. But he brings it back. I'll never forget that. He's like, "You threw my lucky penny out the window. I hate you." He's like, "Just kidding,
yeah,
psych."
Yeah, they show all the good luck charms and stuff. Yeah, those are the two waste gunners who are kind of at odds with it. One is a Irish American type guy, and the other one's an Italian American type guy, and they have that kind of rivalry.
Like
kind
we
of
do.
Funny.
Yeah.
So yeah, I love the movie more than I thought I did. But when it was so weird to me when I'm watching it with my family because I was like, oh, I know lines to this. Like, I know lines to Star Wars. This movie means a lot more to me than I thought it did. So I think it's going to become much more regular viewing for me.
There you go. And you say you watched it with your family. Did your boys pick up on it? Was it a good time?
Yeah, they liked it a lot. I mean, it has plenty of action in it still. It doesn't drag or anything like that. So all the characters are interesting. It's funny because this got some knocks on it by critics. Like they said they couldn't tell the characters apart, which I don't agree with.
Yeah.
I don't agree with at all because
that hit list of people you're talking about, they all have distinct enough faces and they give everybody sort of enough appropriate screen time. Like,
yes, I can tell you the personalities of every single crew member on that aircraft.
There you go.
I mean, it's very well done. You know, you got like the Matthew Modine who plays the pilot is like very like a mom character. Mm-hmm. He's very like protective. And Tate Donovan, the co-pilot, he just wants glory. He wish he could have been a fighter pilot.
Oh, yeah.
And he's like that kind of guy. D.B. Sweeney is scared that he's going to die. So he's all nervous and sweaty and stuff. And Billy Zane's all slick with his little pencil thin mustache. This is pre-Titanic, right?
But that's still Billy Zane. You know? He's been that way since day one. Yep.
Right. You know, but he looks like he's from that era for the love of Pete, mm-hmm. You know, and he was going to medical school. So everyone like acted like he was a doctor, but then it comes out that he doesn't know what he's doing. He was only there for 2 weeks. You know, he overstated it. You know, this is the stuff you learn. And Eric Stoltz is kind of the main character, Danny Boy, who's this redheaded, sweet guy who likes taking photographs and runs the radio and he writes poetry. He's like the nerd,
yeah.
Right? I could keep going. Anyway, all of them have distinct personalities. And, you know, and Harry Connick Jr. is great in it because they just have like a New Orleans kid who grew up in a cat house. So they basically like, you're you.
Yeah, just be you. Also, sing into the camera because we know you're also a crooner. You're an actor slash musician, so
yes,
pay for both of them.
Yeah, where he plays the piano at the party and does Danny Boy and slowly at first, and then it turns into a swing version. Oh, come on.
That's all real. That's all him. Oh,
it's great.
I'm with you. I like I said, I maybe don't give it 8 out of 8, but it is one of those. Here's my argument. I think it was one of those HBO original lineups, like, when your parents signed up for HBO, I think Memphis Belle was part of that. So that may explain why it was part of your viewing experience growing up. But
yeah, I mean, yeah, I was in high school by then. That's when I was really reading the World War II books and stuff. And yeah, so but Memphis Belle.
Oh, Memphis Belle, it's great. Oh, I love it.
All right, so those are our 8 out of 8 movies. So next we're going to talk about television shows. And TV shows, there's, again, if you've been listening to our podcast for any time, Sabrina on Netflix is an 8 out of 8 for both of us. Yep. Firefly is an 8 out of 8.
Buffy.
Buffy, 8 out of 8. Mikey gives Star Trek The Next Generation 8 out of 8.
Yep.
I'm close. That might not, but still, that's a great entry in the Star Trek series, I must say. So things like that, we've been through it. So now we're going to look at things that we haven't really talked about on the show that might let you guys know a little more about us. So, Mikey, what television show did you bring? What pizza box full of 8 slices of TV did you bring?
8 slices full of pineapple and pepperoni, because I'm weird and that's how we're going to do it. But my 8 slices with pineapple on it for TV is a show called Better Off Ted.
Oh, wow.
Do you recognize that name at all?
I 100% recognize that name.
Okay.
But you're going to have to tell me just like 12 Angry Men.
Yes.
I know, but I don't know.
Okay. So here it comes. It is an awfully forgot, like, it's definitely underrated because I guess I'll put the end up in the front, but it only lasted for 2 seasons because not enough people tuned into it. It got canceled because of low viewership. So it never really got the audience that I would say it deserved because I'm arguing it for being 8 out of 8 slices, but Better Off Ted is done by Victor Fresco, who really his only notable creation before that was Andy Richter Controls the Universe. We're fans of Conan O'Brien, and Andy Richter had his little spinoff show for a minute in the 90s, but even then it was a sort of a blip. But Better Off Ted is really just, the main character is called Ted Crisp. He is played by Jay Harrington. It's sort of a character actor name, but Ted Crisp is an executive in this company called Viridian Dynamics. And Viridian Dynamics is sort of the ultimate evil corporation, like even in today's society. They're they're making things at a profit. They're making things that are effective, but also may kind of be bad for the human populace in society, you know?
So you mean every corporation?
Yeah. Like you could say it's Twitter. You could say it's Facebook. You could say it's Amazon. Like, this is a show from, it came out in 2010. So this is a couple years old, but it's kind of funny. I've gone back to watch it. It's kind of funny how relevant it is still to the corporations of today. But other than that, Ted is a good guy and he has a love interest in The Office that is Andrea Anders, a lovely gal. But his boss is also Portia de Rossi that we know from Arrested Development, who plays a cold-hearted executive to a perfect T.
Nice.
But this whole show is satirical. It is sort of the usual kind of Office, kind of Parks and Rec, sort of cubicle farm, like here's a slice of life out of corporations. But there are so many jokes. It is just absurd. Every time they have the option to take like the default joke route or the absurd joke bit, they go the absurd route. And it makes me giggle out loud every time. So I give this 8 out of 8 slices just so more people go watch this, because Better Off Ted was canceled unfairly and more people should see it. So
was it on Fox?
It wasn't on Fox. It was actually on ABC. So,
oh, okay.
Yeah, two seasons.
I just want to hear canceled unfairly, I immediately think Fox.
Oh, they did the worst. They did Firefly. There's so many shows that Fox canceled.
They did enough that The Simpsons were able to fill a graveyard full of them. In one of the.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, the Treehouse of Horror.
Right. That one year where they did Treehouse of Horror, there had been so many canceled shows that people thought were good that they were able to fill a graveyard full of it.
No, I believe it.
So.
But for Better Off Ted, the thing that puts it over the top for Mikey is that there's a sci-fi element to it, because it's a small cast of characters. You have Ted, who's the main character. You have his boss, Portia de Rossi. You have his love interest. And then there's really the only other two characters are two scientists, Lem and Phil, who are like the essential like scientists down in the lab. Your nerds kept in the basement. What are you coming up with for us? But it's one of them is Jonathan Slavin, and you've seen his face. He's one of those character actors that you go, oh, I know that guy, but he's been in everything. And then the jokes are just, it's incredible. One of the episodes, they freeze one of the scientists, like cryogenically freeze him to see like, maybe this is viable for the human public. And it goes successfully, but he gets unfrozen by an accident in about 4 days. So he's like, oh, 4 days. We were planning for about 6 months. Is he going to be okay? And he comes out of it, and he has some problems, but they just write that into the rest of the show.
Oh, man.
But for as silly as this show is, it does have one of the trademarks that it is one of the things that if this happens in a show or a movie, I give it 8 out of 8 slices. For as satirical and as absurd as it is, like it has tones of What We Do in the Shadows or Parks and Rec, like I was saying, there's a wholesomeness to it. Like, there's a daughter character. It's a child actor that's great. There's a love relationship that makes sense. You know, it's a strong female character. All these little things under the surface that, for as weird and as silly as it gets, it's still really wholesome. So it's kind of like perfect watch before bedtime kind of show, which automatically 8 out of 8 slices for Mikey.
That's great. I really can't. I don't even know if I ever saw that show. I've heard of it. Was it a Thursday night show?
Oh, probably.
Yeah. I miss every Thursday night. For our listeners who don't know, for the past 20 years, Thursday night has been the night where our game group meets that Mikey is now a part of. So anything that was on Thursday nights for the past 20 years, I missed it.
I believe you. Yeah, the only reason it is a shame that the only reason it got canceled was because not enough people tuned in. So I believe it that it was probably a Thursday night or a Friday night or just a bad time slot. But yeah. It's on Hulu now, so you can go watch it. And maybe if enough people stream it, we'll get a season 3 in the future, which would be amazing. But we'll see how it goes.
There's always hope. Oh. Well, okay, so my TV show that I'm bringing to the pizza party is kind of a no duh show to a lot of people are probably going to hear it and say no duh, and I don't know if I'm putting this out here to be like, see, I'm a nerd, but at the same time, this show meant a lot to me. I was there from almost the beginning. So I'm bringing a big pizza box full of Mystery Science Theater 3000.
Yes, MST3K.
Bling. Yeah, see, you know what I did there. I always call it MST3K because that's the abbreviation for it that the fans like to use. So my household was the reason why Mikey's kind of more of our movie guy over here, but you have plenty of TV too. But I think I lean more TV because my household was a TV household. I grew up in a house where the TV was never off.
I got you.
And we had cable since I think cable was invented. So in full package stuff. So I was seeing everything. And in the early 90s, when I was an impressionable teen, I started binge watching this channel. There was two stations I was on. I was either on MTV watching videos, or I was on the Comedy Channel. The Comedy Channel eventually became Comedy Central, but originally it was called the Comedy Channel.
Yep.
And one of the first offerings that the Comedy Channel had was this crazy show they pulled out of Minneapolis that was on some public access station there or something called Mystery Science Theater 3000. And it was just enamored. And if you don't know what Mystery Science Theater 3000 is, I don't know why you're listening to this podcast, but but basically it is a show that invented riffing over movies. I don't think anyone did this before that I can think of.
No, they definitely set the standard. Yeah.
But basically they used to always have, and you can back me up on this, like Svengoolie, Elvira, they had these public access shows or, you know, UHF channels or all these words that the younger people don't know what I'm talking about. But they used to have these shows that were on later on at night, and they present these like junky old horror movies or sci-fi movies. And then in between, before the commercials, this character like Elvira or the Svengoolie guy or some goofy character was the presenter of it.
Yep.
And they would tell you about the movie a little bit, and then they kind of make fun of it before they went to commercial and when they came back from commercial and stuff like that. And so it kind of made a movie that you really wouldn't want to sit through palatable because you wanted to see what they had to say about it. But this Mystery Science Theater 3000 took it up to a whole nother level. And they actually made it as if you're sitting there with this guy and his two buddies watching the movie, and they're making fun of it while you're watching it while the movie's playing.
Oh, the best.
At the bottom, you see the little seats. It's iconic at this point. At the bottom, you see the little seats, and then sitting there is the guy and his two robot friends that he built, because they built this whole... They took that whole kind of... There's so many local ones. Like this, I keep going to Svengoolie because he's one that was around here. And Elvira was one of the famous ones. I don't know if you had, wherever you grew up, if you had kind of one of those creature double feature late night hosts that was a local person who was well known.
It was Elvira for me. I don't remember Svengoolie, but I do remember Elvira. She presented the midnight double feature for the people that were still up late. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So they took that part of it and they used that part of it. And like Elvira is supposed to be like mistress of the dark, and it's kind of, she's supposed to be, is she undead? I don't know. This whole thing. But there's this whole kind of like backstory almost made of her and everything. There's a whole thing.
Yep.
So they did it, Mystery Science 3000. They do it as that this guy, Joel, who's the original host, and there was Mike came later, and that's all fine. I love every single host because I love this show. But Joel's the original host. He was sent up into space to be experimented on by two mad scientists who are going to show him bad movies and see if he would go crazy or whatever.
Yep.
And to keep his sanity, Joel built robot friends out of special parts that were in the satellite that's orbiting around. So
he's like a Luke Skywalker. He just made himself some droids. Yeah.
Yeah. So he could keep his sanity. So you got Joel, Crow-T Robot, Tom Servo, Gypsy, and Cambot. Those are all the bots he built. And Joel and Tom Servo and Crow are the ones who sit and watch these movies. And this is a stop down for me on, there's this weird on my Roku, there's this weird Pluto TV that has an MST 3000 channel
on it. Okay.
That I just like, if I don't know what to watch, I'm going to go there and just waste. It's not a waste of time to me. It's just like, this is just, it's comfort. It's just a big bowl of mac and cheese.
Oh, I love it.
And I would say this is a no duh show. This is, but it, when you look up stuff about Mystery Science Theater 2000, they say it's a cult thing, which is weird to me because it's gotten lots of awards and it's gotten lots of acclaim. And in our circles, I think it's pretty much well loved. That's why I say it might be a no duh. But
I'm with you. Like for as much as it's a cult classic, I don't think the general public knows about it. Like they know the concept of people sort of commenting on movies, but they don't know that MST3K was the ones that did it first and did it the best. Because not only were they commenting on movies, but their one-liners are classic. They're quotable. Like. If you ever want to comment with your buddies while you're watching a movie, use an MST3K line and it'll kill. I love it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you might be right. It's really interesting. Like, because, I mean, we run in this fandom circle, in this like fan convention circle. And I think everyone there knows what Mystery Science Theater 3000 is. But I think you're right. I think a lot of other people, and this is like the show that wouldn't die too. It kept getting canceled and revived. And now it's been canceled again after it got revived on Netflix. But the reason why, like, to me, this is that some people don't like subsequent hosts of it. Some people are only Joel guys. Some people like the Mike ones better because basically Joel Hodgson created the show and he was the original host of the show.
Okay.
And at some point he kind of had a falling out with the guy he created it with and sold it to him. So then they had Mike come in, who was the head writer at the time. So he was there the whole time. You would see him even when Joel was on the show.
Oh, okay.
So if you were watching the show the whole time, Mike was familiar. A lot of people think it's a controversial change, but to me it wasn't because I knew who that guy was. He was the guy who sang the Gamera song.
Gamera!
Yeah.
Full of
Gamera
turtle meat.
Is really neat. He is filled with turtle meat. We'll eat you, Gamera. Those are my favorites, by the way, the Gamera ones. They did a whole string of Gamera ones, and those are my favorite. But
Gamera is the knockoff Godzilla, right? So it's Godzilla?
He's a turtle, and and he can fly around by he pulls his head and arms in, and then like sparklers come out, and he spins around in a circle like a UFO and flies.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. He's the best.
Have you ever seen the Gamera movies outside of MST3K, or is it
why would you want to?
Why would
no,
you?
No, they're terrible.
Yeah, I get it.
But MST3K has actually done Godzilla movies, too. You can see them do Godzilla movies.
Oh, that's right.
So what's interesting about that show is it was on Comedy Central, Comedy Channel 2 Comedy Central for a long time. Mm-hmm. Then it got canceled off of there, and then Sci-Fi picked it up. And Mike Nelson was the head writer that he became the host. And he was the host mostly for the Sci-Fi days. And in the Sci-Fi days, they could only do sci-fi movies. So that was kind of an interesting era. And then it got canceled. And then Joel ended up buying it back and then doing that Kickstarter to get it on Netflix.
Oh, okay. I didn't know it was Joel. I figured it would have been Mike Nelson, the head writer.
But... No, Joel bought it back and brought it back. So it's on Netflix now. There's a whole bunch of select original ones, and then there's the new series that has Jonah Ray as the host, and I mean Patton Oswalt and his Felicia Day. They pulled out like let's find everybody nerds love, and a lot of the we call ourselves Misties, the fans. The reason why this to me is like I keep calling stuff Star Wars because Star Wars is one of those things that I love so much that even I've softened on the prequels over the years.
Mm-hmm.
So just because I love it too much. And Mystery Science Theater 2000 to me too is like, no matter who the host is, I like them all. I've never not enjoyed myself sitting there watching them riff on stuff. Just the format, the funny interstitials, the goofy models. I mean, it just delights me. It just delights me.
I'm on board with you loving all of it, but I think the nerd debate is, I think you have to, like, in terms of Star Wars fans, you have to pick whether you like the original trilogy or the prequels or the new era. Do you have a favorite host? Because we now have three of them. We have Joel, Mike, and Jonah Ray, who we love from the Nerdist podcast, but do you have a favorite that you would pick over the others just for sake of argument?
So I'm telling you, though, I mean, I'm going to put the caveat, and I know I'm not trying to be a cop-out, but I really do like them all in the role. They all bring different things, and I think they're all good.
Okay.
But Joel is the first one I ever saw, and he's the one that I saw for years and years and years. And his whole, since it's his show, and it has kind of his sensibilities, so even though, like, the thing is, too, is that when Mike was the head writer during that whole time anyway, so when he came to be the host, the sensibility was still there.
Yeah, yeah.
But Joel just has this funny, sleepy goofiness to him. You know, Mike's a little slicker. Mike's, in a lot of ways, Mike is a better host just because he's better at kind of doing hosting, acting, all that kind of stuff.
And if he's the head writer, he's writing it in his voice, so he has a little bit of an edge up knowing what, you know, knowing the delivery of the bits and all that.
Right. But Joel's lovable goofiness, just his whole, there's something lovable about Joel. You have to admit it.
Oh, I admit it freely. But also, yeah. I do want to give a shout out to Jonah Ray, because we've mentioned in the last couple episodes that we're sort of reboot averse, but I will say this, the reboot of Mystery Science Theater 3000 goes in the column of reboots that were worth it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Jonah Ray seems like one of us, that he's raised on the original and loves it and understands its whole purpose and delivers his host duties on that principle and just kills it. I'm sad. I'm sad that it got canceled, but maybe it'll come back again. It can never die.
It can't, because it's based, it has the through line of those old horrible movies where stuff just keeps coming back to life.
And they keep making horrible movies, so
yeah,
that show can never die.
All right, so our final box of pizza is the video game box.
Dun, dun, dun.
So now Mikey would normally, Legend of Zelda would be an 8 out of 8 for him. He's talking about it on the podcast a million times.
Oh, any, Legend of Zelda for sure. Any Nintendo game. There's a bunch of them. I mean, I am a millennial, so I got my start on the regular Nintendo, more the Super Nintendo. But I've been playing video games for a long time. But the reason I pick my 8 out of 8 video game pizza extravaganza is because this is a ridiculous game that I've probably spent the most hours on.
Ah.
And it is Skate 3, a skateboarding game.
Skate 3, not even Tony Hawk.
Not even Tony Hawk. We've talked about it on the podcast. We said it on Nerd Alerts that I was super excited for the reboot, which is excellent, and I'm still, I happily play that. But Skate 3, I guess, is the hipster equivalent to Tony Hawk, maybe?
Oh, Mikey's showing his hipster card.
It might be, but Skate 3 is done by EA, a company that you either love or hate, depending on what's going on in the news. But it's also by a company called Black Box. So it's two companies that put it together. But Skate 3 takes all the magic of Tony Hawk, but they add a control scheme that's, for a controller, I don't know, this is weird to say, but for a controller, it feels like you're actually skateboarding. And this is where the bias comes in, because if there's one skill I wish I had, like a genie could grant you a wish and say, hey, what do you wish you could do? Just magically, I would pick two things, skateboarding and drumming. I don't know why skateboarding is one of them, but that's in there. I watch way too many skate videos on YouTube. I love skate video soundtracks. I love Tony Hawk, like we're saying. But for Skate 3, it is like you're skateboarding with your hands, and it's pure zen. There aren't as many famous skaters like you have in Tony Hawk, so there is a little bit of that downturn. But for all the people that love Tony Hawk for the soundtrack, there's a great soundtrack in this one. And I don't know, I have to describe the control scheme because it's so well. Like, on your modern controllers, because this came out on the Xbox 360, which is when dual sticks came into popularity, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's all where the controls take place, is on those dual sticks. Your left stick is your sort of your front foot, and your right stick is sort of your back foot. And that's it. Like, it's just the two stick controls, and you can skate all day long.
Oh, wow.
And also there's like different modes where there's Hall of Meat, where instead of doing like cool tricks or cool videos or cool skate stuff, you can actually just mess up on purpose and see how many bones you can break, and you get points for how many bones you can break. It's ridiculous. So, like, there's two options. You can either go zen and just skate around like you would out in a park in California, or you could decide that you're having an angry day and you want to destroy your skater. So let's get some points for, like, headbutting the concrete or something like that.
Oh, man, that's crazy. So, like, do you literally, like, use one of the sticks to, like, push the skateboard?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
It's one stick, like I'm saying, it's one stick for your front foot, so you control your direction and how fast you're going. And then the other stick is your back foot, which controls like your kick flip, your heel flip, your push it 360, all that stuff. It's incredibly accurate. Like, so props to the game designers, because I mean, skateboarding to video games never really translates even for Tony Hawk. But for this one, you're like, oh, I'm kind of actually skateboarding with my thumbs.
When you talk about skateboarding with your hands, it reminds me of, and I think they came back, but when I was in junior high school in the ancient times, they used to make these like little tiny skateboards.
Yeah, the fingerboards, the tech boards.
The fingerboards, yeah. And they had like, is it tape? Whatever that stuff is, that grippy tape stuff. Mm-hmm. They were an accurate little tiny skateboard.
Yep.
And I remember kids on the bus all the time, like finger skateboarding with it. And some kids got really good. They could do flips and ollies and all that kind of stuff.
I bought a bunch of those fingerboards. I was never good at it. Like, I was never good at actual skateboarding, but I enjoy it for the same principle. It's just, there's something about it. It's relaxing to me. And the same with the video game. It's so well done that you can just sit there and sort of just kill an hour. Like, oh, I'm going to go skate around this park and do some tricks and maybe meet up with some friends. I don't know. It's silly.
It's sort of the fidget spinners of the late 80s.
I'd buy it as a millennial fidget spinner. Yeah.
Oh, man. That's great. I've never even seen that game before. You're pulling out all kinds of stuff. Now, my pizza, again, I'm bringing favorite pizzas for a lot of people, but they're also my favorite, too. But the reason why I'm bringing this video game is because I didn't realize how weird it was for me to play it until I was talking to my friends about it. And they're like, you play that? So, and then I started looking at demographics and stuff, and it is kind of weird that I play it. So my 8 out of 8 pizza game is Minecraft.
Ooh, okay, Minecraft.
Now, Minecraft is obviously everywhere. People have seen it. They have a cereal. And it's all over the place. But some people might say it's a no duh. But, I mean, I'm a 40-year-old guy. And if you look at the demographics, the average age of a Minecraft player is 24 years old.
Okay. So I would have skewed that younger, but 24 makes sense.
Yeah, I'm kind of playing a kid's game in a lot of ways. And I was told that by my friends, because what happened is that we have a group of nerd friends, right? Mm-hmm. Who are all 30s and 40s, some even older. And we'll get together on the Xbox and play things like Red Dead and Star Wars Squadrons and mm-hmm. all kinds of things like that. That kind of makes sense for our age range. And one time I was online, I was playing Minecraft, and one of my friends, 100% assumed, is like, why are your kids up playing on the Xbox at like midnight?
It's not my kids, it's me.
Yeah, it wasn't my kids, it's me. Now, they are the ones who introduced me to Minecraft. It is, my kids were 14. It's their generation's game, big time. They absolutely love it. And it's a thing that you can play 4 people on a screen. So it's a couch co-op game.
Okay.
And I love video games, and I wanted to play video games with my boys. So we've been playing Minecraft for years together. And it was one of those things where sometimes you play stuff, like we used to have we originally started with like a PlayStation 2. And when they were real little, we were playing Little Big Planet.
Oh, yeah.
That's
like
kind of a fun game. Now, Little Big Planet, I never played that without them. It was just always just the game we played together. But Minecraft, I started to find myself like sneaking off and like playing Minecraft at night instead.
You needed that extra fix. I got you.
So Minecraft is so much fun. For those of you who don't know, it's a sandbox game, and it's kind of done, it's really blocky, kind of done 8-bit. It felt real comfortable to me because it looks old. It's not new, super high graphics. It's old. That's why a lot of people think it's almost like how people kind of diminish anime, because they're like, it's a cartoon, right?
I get it.
It's like, oh, this looks like kiddie, so it must be kiddie.
It's really isometric. It's really pixelated. It is sort of low render kind of stuff, but yeah.
But man, it's so deep and it's so well thought out. And if you put an engine on it that looked like a Red Dead or something, it would be totally perceived differently. But I mean, I like to play it on survival mode. A lot of people play it on creative mode, where it's basically just like Legos, virtual Legos, where you can build anything out of these blocks. And some people do insane builds. And I like to go on the Reddit Minecraft to see what people are building, because people do insane things that take so much time.
Yeah, they're building castles and towns or statues and artwork. Yeah, crazy.
And replicas of things in real life. And there was one server where they built the entire Starship Enterprise. And it's accurate.
Nice.
I mean, it's accurate, like level by level. It's crazy. Anyway, I really don't like creative mode that much. To me, I like survival mode. Now, survival mode is you start off with like a map and nothing, and you're just in like the woods.
It's like you're stranded on an island. You're a naked sort of shipwreck. Like,
right.
Here you go.
That's what it's like. To the point that Max Brooks, Mel Brooks' son, who's a writer, World War Z, I believe is what his biggest thing.
And his first book, Guide to the Zombie Apocalypse. He was the first one to publish a zombie plan. Yeah.
Right. So he played Minecraft with his kids and then ended up writing Minecraft related books.
Oh, fun.
And it is that very thing. It's written from the perspective of I woke up stranded on an island with nothing. And this, he basically wrote down what he did in Minecraft.
Okay.
And turned it into a best-selling book. So that's how much fun this game is. So you have to survive. And like monsters come out at night. And, you know, and you have to like build a shelter, find fire, find food, hunt, fish. You can find old ruins, you can find treasure, mines and dungeons, and it's crazy. There's so much going on in this game. When it started, there wasn't as much, but they're constantly updating this game for free, I must say, and adding new things and new things and new things all the time. And it's one of the biggest games in the world. It's really hugely popular, but apparently not with people my age. So that's why I'm calling that kind of my odd thing to be, because to me it's not that odd to be 8 out of 8 because it's huge. But
yeah, I think it outsold Tetris, right? Something like that.
Yeah. So it might seem obvious, but I found out from nerds that I hang out with that it's nerdy to play Minecraft at my age. It's odd to play Minecraft at my age. So
I believe.
I don't know. What happens is a lot of time is that there's another game called, I forget what it's called right now. Anyway, there's other games out there that have taken the Minecraft idea and have skinned it with a really good engine, a really good graphics to make it look like a Red Dead or whatever.
I got you.
To try and make it work for the older market.
Mm-hmm.
But I've been told about that, like almost in a way that people are like, you should really be playing this one, old man. And I'm like, no, I like Steve and his blockiness and all the goofy blocky things. But dude, even my kids say Minecraft can be a horror game sometimes. It's like crazy. I don't know if you've heard about the creepers, those little green goofy looking things.
Little cactus looking enemies, right? That's
yeah.
Okay. Yes. So that's what
they're called,
up
creepers.
Okay.
Now the funny thing about that is that Notch, who made this game, he made this game in Java in 2009. It was a Java game.
Just one dude too. That's impressive.
Yeah. He's from the Nordic country. I forget where, but his name, everyone, Marcus Notch Pearson, and everyone calls him Notch. He was trying to program a pig, make a pig. There are pigs in the game. And he got that weird green creeper thing. So he kept it. And what the creeper does is it silently walks up behind you and explodes.
And it hisses like a snake, too. Like,
yes.
You get
yes,
a weird little hisses, sound like, I think something's
wrong. It hisses before
wrong.
It explodes. Yeah, it hisses before it explodes. And it's terrifying because you have to like constantly watch out for these stupid things. and you have to like, you're always looking around. You're always looking over your shoulder to make sure there's not a creeper around. I mean, geez. And then when you get in the desert and there are actual cactuses around, that's just like even more terrifying. You don't know how many times you're like, and you're like, oh, that's a cactus. I mean, this is like the graphics are like cartoony, but you're still sitting there scared half to death.
Yep.
Trying to survive. If it starts getting dark out and you don't think you have enough equipment to handle all the monsters, you're like literally like double tapping on the stick to run as fast as you can to get back to your shelter. I mean, it's crazy. It's so much fun.
And the first day you got to do a makeshift shelter just so you survive the night.
Yes. Yes. Before you can get a bed. But it's my favorite thing is to find fun seeds and see if I can survive and get to a point where I can do creative mode type stuff in survival mode. Like you're so powerful that you can build a castle, but it's in survival mode. That's to me, that's like when you're like killing the game. That's so much fun to me.
So I only know Minecraft from the creative mode, and I love it because it is one of those sort of, like, it's been around so long that the PC culture has sort of done a whole bunch of mods, so even if you don't like the graphics, you can find different mods to make the graphics better and more lifelike.
Yeah.
But for survival mode, does that mean there's like an end game to it? Like, can you beat Minecraft, or is it just sort of a...
You can.
Oh.
You can. The end is literally called the end. You go to the end. It's a place.
Okay.
It's a place. So there's the overworld, and then there's an underworld called the Nether, which you have to build a Nether portal to get to, which is almost like a hellscape. It's all lava and fire, and you can find all kinds of things down there. But then there's also the end, where you have to find an ender portal, and you have to get ender pearls and put it in the ender portal to activate it. And then you can go to the end, where the endermen live, and there's an ender dragon there. And if you defeat the ender dragon, you've won Minecraft.
Oh, that's fun.
So, yeah, there is a point.
I figured it would have just been endless, but oh, the fact that they have endermen and all that lore behind it, that's super cool.
Yeah, if you want to have a fun little video, there's a lot of people who try and speed run to get to the end of the game as quick as they can.
Oh, that's a sign of a good game when you have speedrunners trying to burn through it.
Right, and there's always current record, and there's always a current famous person who broke it, so or becomes famous for breaking it. So,
well, then I hope to see you on that list of people that have gotten to the Nether, the Ender Realm.
It's called the End.
The End.
It's literally just called The End.
If you love this game so much, then I want to see you on the End speedrunner list. Let's do it. Or your boys.
I don't like speed. I don't like speed running.
Okay.
But anyway. So, man, I am stuffed full of pizza. We usually say our pizza's here, but we brought it at the beginning.
Yeah, these are all our favorite things. These are all our comfort foods, and we're feasting on them and recommending to others because they're so delicious and tasty.
So, everybody, let us know what your 8 out of 8, your pizza you like to bring to the party is that someone might not think would be an 8 out of 8 pizza. We're looking for your Buckaroo Banzais, your Memphis Belles, your
12 Angry Men.
Yes. Yeah. Or Movie Steves. And let us know if you like this. We figure we could do this with anything. We can do this with like breakfast cereals and stuff. So if you like the concept of the pizza party, let us know. You can let us know at Assuming Pod on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also Gmail us, assumingpositions@gmail.com. We want to thank you guys so much for listening. Please continue to share, circulate the tapes, as the Missy used to say.
Yes.
Like, share, go to whatever platform you're listening on. Give it 5 stars, thumbs up, 10 out of 10, whatever they allow, 8 out of 8 slices. So thanks so much for listening. We also want to thank that guy, Brad, for doing our announcing, Not Scott Productions for our equipment, Jazzar for our music, and we hope you guys have a great turkey day that's coming up. Gobble, gobble.
Gobble, gobble. Thanksgiving. Happy bring holidays.
Pizza. Sorry. Bring pizza.
Bring pizza.
Do you ever have pizza Thanksgiving? That's weird.
I haven't, turkey but that'd pizza. Be a good... Could you do turkey pizza? Is that a thing?
Or just bring pizza to have on the side.
No, I want some stuffing pizza. I want some crazy Thanksgiving pizza.
Stuffing pizza. Okay. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Everybody, welcome to the Assuming Positions podcast. Kevin over here.
And Mikey over here.
And today on the podcast, inspired by a listener email.
Yes.
People read our podcast all the time. Inspired by a listener email is what we're calling, this is a new idea, a pod segment. I won't call it a segment because it's an entire podcast worth, but.
Yes.
It's a new show. Mm-hmm. What do we call it? A new episode? I don't know what we call these different things that we do.
A new
They're
theme.
Not segments.
A new theme.
Theme. Yes. Theme. We'll call them themes.
Yes.
This is a new theme. We're calling the pizza party 8-slice extravaganza.
Dun, dun, dun. Inspired by John Jordan. Shout out to you. Thanks again.
Yes. So last week we read a reader email from John. Reader. I keep saying reader. Start over. I got to start over. And I want you to say pizza party 8-slice extravaganza in your voice that you do when you're reading off the cards when we're playing Cards Against Humanity.
Done. Okay.
All right. Let's start over.
Fresh.
Let's start over.
And Mark.
Let's start over. Okay. Sorry, future Mikey. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Assuming Positions podcast. Kevin over here.
And Mikey over here.
And today on the podcast, we have a whole new theme that we came up with. Yes. It's called...
Pizza party. It's called Pizza Party. Why do I keep saying strice? Eight slice extravaganza. Whatever. You got to say pizza party, and then I go. Okay. We're having a Saturday. It's great. We're having a good time.